Hey everyone, it's Colin. How's it going? So you may have noticed that recently I've been kind of getting back into doing video game mod episodes again. It had been a decent stretch of time since I had last done one. I don't know for sure off the top of my head, but there are two recent ones that I put out. The first one was that video output mod for the Atari 5200. That ended up being kind of an interesting jumping off point for me mentally, because right around the time I was producing that video, I caught wind of another really interesting mod that had come out. You probably saw this episode, the replacement LCD screen for the original Game Boy. And it's that mod that's kind of gotten me thinking, and it's what I want to explore in this podcast episode. And that is why game console modding in general has become so much more popular and also become so much more advanced. You look at some of the original console modding episodes that I did. The very first one that I did, really, and what I don't want to say put me on the map, because I don't feel like I'm still even anywhere on the map, that is YouTube, but that got some decent traction with viewers, I should say, was the replacement LCD screen for the original Game Boy Advance. Doing the AGS 101 screen mod to that console. And that's, in terms of complexity, actually really straightforward, because it's just a conversion cable and you plug it in and you're done, right? That, like, it's, there's not a whole lot to it. But compared to what was available prior, it was a pretty advanced, pretty mind-blowing in some ways to some people, kind of a mod. What we had prior to this kind of 2010s resurgence in game console modding really kind of fell into two camps. You had either electrical mods or appearance mods. And what kind of mods you got were very, very different based on the console you wanted to do them to. Some consoles were very simple in terms of what was available and always stayed fairly limited, right? So for the longest time, mods for, say, the Super NES, you know, it really kind of came down to just being like, well, you know, defeating the region lockout on it. That was pretty much all the more you could do with that console for a long time. Same thing with the N64. N64 is probably a better example because I've actually done mod videos on that one. For the longest time, throughout the 90s and the early 2000s, really the only mod you could do for the N64 was, you know, like maybe like a replacement shell if you could find one that was like a different color, you know, that kind of stuff. Very, very simple. And by contrast, there were other consoles that went way further, but they were all just kind of piggybacking on existing technology already in the console. So I'm thinking stuff like mod chips. You know, mod chips for the original PlayStation were incredibly popular and incredibly common. You know, you'd either have a chip you'd solder inside the machine, or there were some that plugged into like that expansion port on the back. You'd stick a spring inside the CD, the flip-up cover for the CD drive to make the console think the lid was always closed so that you could do the disc swap trick, you know, because you had to have an original disc. Even with the mod chip, you had to have an original disc in there in order to boot the console up, and then the mod chip allowed you to swap the disc real quick with like a, you know, a burned copy of whatever game, and the console wouldn't know the difference. It was all that kind of stuff. The original Xbox, I would say, really kind of blew that wide open just because of its architecture and the operating system it ran. It was effectively a PC. Me and the Xbox, I did an episode on this where I explored game console operating systems. That was a lot of fun to research. But because it was kind of a known quantity in terms of its hardware and its software, kind of a known quantity, people who produced, you know, mods and upgrades and everything for it, they were able to go really far. But none of the stuff during that era of like the 90s and the early 2000s, none of those mods were really terribly like novel. They were all, like I said, just kind of extending on what was already there in the console, right? So they were mod chips. They were ways to install a larger hard drive, you know, with a non-official replacement. Microsoft was infamous for doing that, you know, like they locked the hard drive to the console and you had to get, you know, one of their special ones or whatever. It turns out it was just firmware kind of a thing, you know, or special formatting. You know, same thing with Sony, like the PlayStation lineup. It was, you know, it was basically just mod chips and that kind of stuff. None of it was like, oh, suddenly now you've got twice the graphics horsepower, or suddenly, you know, the video quality is dramatically better, or any of that kind of stuff. It was all just that kind of iterative work. And then to kind of dovetail with that, there were, for some consoles, the appearance mods. And this generally was just stuff like replacement shells. I remember that especially for the PlayStation, especially the PS1, like the Slim, the second gen of the original PlayStations. There was a period of time when there were just tons and tons of replacement, like, housings on the market, all sorts of colors. There were translucent ones, there were solid ones. I think there was even like a glow in the dark one. It was nuts, you know. And then people would also take it upon themselves to customize them themselves. If there was one in a specific color, specific color pattern or whatever, people would paint them, you know, to do exactly what they want, you know, like mirror finish, you know, glossy silver, whatever, you know, chrome it out, that kind of stuff. It was nuts, that era. But again, it was all kind of iterative. Now, though, and I would say it's been like this for probably approaching 10 years, but I don't know when it really started picking up, but soon enough it'll be 10 years. We turned a corner in terms of the quality and type of mods that we have available. Mods for the, you know, those consoles that got mod chips, so like the PlayStation, the Xbox, that kind of stuff, you don't see those anymore. Nobody's really interested in doing those anymore. Mostly because I'd say, one, the games from those consoles are generally all available on other platforms now. They're available to play elsewhere now. That and the quality of emulation is so high that there's less of a desire to play them on original hardware, simply because the only real draw to that hardware back when it was new was the quality of gameplay. You know, the graphics quality kept getting better and better. People weren't so nuts about, like, the physical hardware of the console itself. That really was kind of irrelevant. I mean, it's a home console. How excited can you get about the physical, you know, aspect of that console? You're not going to, like, sit there and hold it in your hands and, you know, fawn over it. You're going to put it in your entertainment center or on your shelf or whatever, hooked up to your TV, and you're going to play the games. That's really why you buy it. So if you've got other ways to play those games, especially with as good, if not better quality, because some of the emulators can do magic to make the games look even better than they did on original consoles, you know, that original hardware doesn't really matter so much anymore. So we haven't really seen much of a resurgence for that. But where the innovation is coming into play are those consoles where the hardware maybe did matter, or at least the hardware people think of fondly, or there was something special about the original hardware that, you know, makes people nostalgic about it. And then also handhelds, of course, because handhelds are one of those types of gaming platforms where that physicality, the hardware itself, does kind of play a part in the overall experience, right? Because you're touching it. The screen quality, the graphics quality, the ergonomics, just the feel of it, its portability, its battery life, all of those things come together in a comprehensive package in ways that doesn't happen with home consoles. With home consoles, you know, the extent of your interaction with it, let's look at, say, something like the PS4. The extent of your interaction with the PS4 is going to be sticking a disc in the drive, which it's a slot load drive, so what? the user interface on screen, so moving, you know, between all the menus and choosing options and all that, and then the controller itself. That's really all the more you're going to interact with one of those consoles. Whereas with a handheld, obviously it's right there and you are holding the console. You are holding the device that you are playing the game on. You know what I mean? And so now we're seeing these crazy mods, especially for the handhelds, that push the consoles much farther than they've ever been. And in ways that we didn't see with electrical mods for consoles back in the 90s and 2000s. These mods now are not just enhancing the existing capabilities of the consoles. In some ways, they are replacing functionality in the consoles or upgrading them in ways that were simply not possible at any cost when those consoles were new. And that's why that DMG IPS screen mod really caught my attention. The quality on that one is so high. That quality of screen just didn't exist back when the Game Boy was brand new. And it really arguably didn't really even exist in the 90s. There may have been small, really high quality backlit LCDs available in the late 90s, but they, in those sizes, they were going to be really expensive. So to see a kit with such a high quality, really crisp, just easy to install screen like that for a pretty decent price. I mean, those kits are going for about $75 US. That's really kind of pushing us into like the second generation of game console modding. I feel like there was kind of a lull, I think, industry wide for maybe the last 2 years. You know, we saw that kind of first push, the first generation, whatever you want to call it, in the beginning of the 2010s, things like the AGS 101 screen mod on the original GBA, that kind of stuff, where it was simply swapping out parts, you know, to make things better. Still using kind of the fundamental technology. It just happens to be like, oh, this one just happens to work, kind of a thing. And people jump all over those, rightfully so, because they were really popular and they were really, for their time, really advanced and produced excellent results. And those mods still hold up generally. And we started to see some custom stuff get built. It wasn't just, oh, hey, if you take this part and substitute it for this other part, it works. And hey, look how cool the results are. An entire cottage industry sprung up around manufacturing these retro gaming upgrade and mod parts. There are, you know, many manufacturers or at least resellers out there now that have, you know, set up their entire storefronts like that's all they sell. They're all around the world. And so, you know, we saw parts like the front light kits, the backlight kits for the Game Gear. A great example, the backlight kit to replace the, you know, the crappy backlight that was in that screen. The Game Gear, honestly, is a console that I'm not going to lie, I kind of hate it. But that's a story for another time. You know, front light kits for like the Game Boy Color and, you know, backlight kits, of course, for the original Game Boy. They were inexpensive parts to install, but they were tricky. The results were often really good, but it was still kind of within the context of like you're modding what's already in the console type of a thing, right? It was that little baby step, that iterative, you know, kind of feel like, okay, so you're still using the original screen that was in that DMG, but now you're modifying it and putting a backlight in there. And yeah, it's really tricky. And it's really complicated for someone who's never done that kind of thing before. So there was a learning curve. Some of those mods, that learning curve was pretty steep. A good example of that, where we're starting to get, you know, in time, we're starting to get better and better with these mods and people are putting more into them was, like I alluded to a little bit ago, the N64. So there was this thing called the Ultra HDMI that came out, and it was a graphics output option for the Nintendo 64 that would give you HDMI output. And it wasn't simply an upscaler. It didn't simply take like the compositor S video out and turn it into HDMI. that's what up until that point everyone had done, is they had either like RGB modded or just, you know, stuck a FrameMeister or something on the output of their N64. And they were happy with that. I mean, it produced good results, definitely better than what you would have gotten natively out of the console. But the Ultra HDMI was a big step forward. And I should add other mods like it, because it wasn't the only one that did this sort of thing, but it's the example I'm using here. The Ultra HDMI was a really big step forward in terms of this progression or this evolution of game console modding that we're seeing through the 2010s, because it interfaced directly with some of the chips on the motherboard of the N64. It was difficult to install. In fact, the manufacturer of the Ultra HDMI basically only sold it to people and companies who would install the mod for them. There was only, I think, one or maybe two of those people, those companies who did the mods, who were willing to resell the mods on to Joe Schmoes like me, who wanted to install them themselves and were willing to take on the risk. And that was an advanced mod. And I'm not going to lie, when I was producing that video of how to install it, I was really nervous because it's a lot of thin flat flex cables. You need to drag solder onto them. The pin spacing on those chips is really tight, so solder bridging those chips together was difficult. For a beginner, there's no way they would have been able to do it. And I had one shot because I only had one spare N64. And of course, N64 hardware prices had continued to rise, so it would have been an expensive mistake had I screwed it up during the production of that video. But the results spoke for themselves in terms of just how high a quality you got out of that. And that mod really spoke to me like, okay, people are starting to put some serious engineering into these mods. And it kind of progressed, you know, from there. But I felt like starting in, 2018, maybe. I can't really put my finger on exactly when, but towards the end of the 2010s, things just kind of stagnated. It seemed like there really wasn't a whole lot of super innovative stuff coming out that was continuing to raise that bar. It felt like, okay, well, we kind of got what we got, and now we're, you know, everyone's just going to kind of go for the ride, you know, with what's out there, you know. But that IPS mod, the thing that gets me about the IPS mod isn't necessarily like, wow, they took, you know, a replacement screen and managed to get it to work with a DMG, because people had been doing that too, right? There was the Ben Venn Game Boy Color backlit screen mod, where he found, you know, a replacement LCD screen and created an interposer board that had, I think he used a CPLD, I can't quite remember what type of chip. He used a chip on there to translate the video signals, you know, from the Game Boy motherboard into what the screen wanted to see, and managed to make it work. And we saw other companies do that. I mean, I did another one from Midwest Embedded. You know, they advanced that design a little more in terms of making the board thinner and smaller and kind of easier to install in the console, that sort of thing. And that's great. But these, again, are all just kind of, you know, tack-on parts. What really got me about that Game Boy IPS mod wasn't necessarily the screen. As good as that screen does look really good, the thing that got me about that mod was the fact that the manufacturer built a replacement front PCB. It seems like a small thing at first, but consider the ramifications of it. The front PCB on the original DMG was the bane of a lot of modders' existence because the original LCD was soldered directly to it. And it's soldered to it in two places, one of which is very difficult to access. It makes replacing that screen, like in case you screw up an old school backlight mod, old school in quotes, backlight mod, you know, where you're peeling the film off the back of the LCD and sticking the backlight panel in there, like I did, you know, in a couple of my episodes. You know, people would screw that up. And for practical purposes, if you screwed it up, you had to get a new Game Boy. Because the original LCD was soldered to that front board. The original LCD was a custom part. You couldn't find just the LCD. Even if you could find an original LCD, you'd have to be knowledgeable and skilled enough to be able to desolder the old one and solder the new one on. And that's tricky. And then, you know, what if there was something wrong with the front panel board? That was a custom part. You know, all this stuff. It basically meant it so that if you screwed up doing a backlight mod, the Game Boy was trash. And I saw that frequently in comments on those videos from people saying, hey, I've never done a mod before. I tried this one. I screwed it up. I had to go buy another Game Boy. That's a real bummer. And I feel for them. I absolutely feel for them because I want people to start getting into modding and furthering their own skills and abilities. I mean, I've had people say, oh, dude, you make it look so easy in your videos. And I don't know how to not make it look easy. I mean, I try to include my fails when I can, but just the nature of editing video, you don't want to sit there and watch me struggle to solder this thing for 15 minutes straight, right? I got to cut to the chase because watching me struggle with, you know, a solder joint that doesn't want to behave or whatever isn't really the point of what I'm trying to get across in the episode. And talking about trying to come up with the pacing and the you know, the timing and the editing of an episode is best saved for another conversation. Let me know if you want to hear about that. But, you know, where the mind-blowing thing, I think, for me comes with that IPS mod is that front panel PCB. That the company bothered to design a replacement one. It fits perfectly and it is just drop-in simple. It's that mod is so simple. I would argue that a lot of people who have never done modding before could do that DMG IPS mod. What's even more interesting is some companies are piggybacking on that one. Like I showed in that particular episode, how I ended up using some double stick tape to hold the screen, the replacement screen, in the right position in the housing. Because the manufacturer, for some strange reason, never really accommodated that. I guess they just figured, well, people will just tape it in. Well, since that episode went live, I've learned that there's at least one company, probably more, that have designed and are now selling 3D printed brackets specifically for holding that screen in for that mod. And that's what I love to see, is now we're taking it even further into simplicity, making it approachable, making it easy for people who want to get into it. Because that's how you increase kind of the uptake of these mods, how you increase the visibility, how you get it out to more people who would want something like that, but don't really know it exists. You know, making this stuff simpler and really approachable, I think, is how the whole community is going to continue to grow and evolve and get even further into these mods. And I think it's a turning point that we're starting to get into actually replacing parts from these original consoles and not just tacking stuff on. Now, there's the whole Ship of Theseus argument going on, and that's actually something that people kind of misconstrued in that episode as well, the DMG IPS mod episode, is some people thought that that board was the guts of the Game Boy, and I wish I had been a little more clear. I did state it in the episode. It's only replacing this front board. You're still using the backboard, but I now wish I had clarified that the rear PCB is actually the brains of the Game Boy. And the front PCB, even the original front PCB, all that thing is just an interface to the screen and the front buttons and the speaker. So I wish I had spelled it out a little more clearly in that episode that, you know, it's really no big deal that you're replacing the front panel because this thing still acts like a Game Boy, right? Because it is. The original chips, the cartridge slot, all the logic circuitry is still original. Now, it does raise an interesting question, like mentioned the whole Ship of Theseus thing, like how far will that go? Will we ever get to a point where people are actually making like direct replacement boards for all of the parts in something like Game Boy? Now, there's legal questions around that, of course, because they're going to have to replicate, you know, copyrighted and trademarked and whatever functionality that Nintendo came up with if they go down that path. But that is something I'm a little bit hesitant about as to, you know, will the community kind of find a natural balance there as to, like, there's a line you don't cross as to parts that get replaced, you know, to produce something that basically takes, I don't know, you could say the soul away from a console versus like, no, we're only going to replace up to here. And then anything beyond that needs to stay original. Will the community figure that out? I hope so. I don't know. And I don't know exactly where that line would get drawn if everyone, you know, one ever does. But that is something I think people are apprehensive about. Nevertheless, I'm still excited for it because now we're going to, I think, start to see other companies, other people designing replacement parts like that for the really problematic things. Another great example is the N64 controller. Some people love to hate it. I happen to really like it. But I think one thing that has affected everybody is the thumbstick and how that thing wears down and gets loose over time. And people came up with homebrew ways to kind of, you know, make it be less bad, to tighten it back up again. But there have been companies that have produced replacement parts for that, made out of different materials that won't wear as fast or at all and totally fixes the problem. That is the direction I think the whole console modding community needs to continue to take. Let's take the most painful parts or the most limiting parts of these consoles, the things we always hated, or the things that always gave us trouble, the things we always had to work around when doing other mods, and let's just fix them for good. And that is going to be really exciting to see where that goes. Now, another kind of part of this whole thing, you're getting, I guess, a double-sized episode this time, is like, how did we get to this point? Right? Like, it's one thing that we got here, that they're producing these, you know, level of replacement parts, these advanced of replacement parts and mod parts. But how did we even get here? Well, I think there's three reasons to it, kind of three parts to it. The first one is simply renewed interest, generally fed by nostalgia, right? You've got certain age groups of people, I would say anyone kind of in their mid-20s through early to mid-40s. Those are people who grew up with those consoles and they have nostalgia for them and they've got some expendable income and they're interested in those old consoles again, but they pick them up, they go on eBay or they go to a local retro gaming store or whatever and they get one. And like with the case of the Game Boy, because I think it's a great example, you know, they kit it all out, they get all the games and everything that they wanted and they turn it on and they realize, damn, that original screen sucks. At least in comparison to modern handheld devices, right? They hold up a Game Boy and they hold up their modern smartphone and they go, wow, what a difference here. So those mods instantly capture their attention when they find out about them. And even if those mods aren't cheap, like, you know, the older just drop in, the, you know, where you'd peel the film off the back. I don't know what to call those. The peel the film off the back kind of backlights for the DMG. We'll call them the original backlights for the DMG. Those are cheap. I mean, those are like $10-$12 for that part. And I would say most anyone who's into retro gaming could afford that. These new ones, you know, $75, that's a decent chunk of change. But you know what? If you're a 30-something or a 40-something year old, you are a little more established in your career, you've got some expendable income, you know, you could skip going to the bar this week and afford that, you know, or skip doing something else, you know, that kind of is a way to piss away money and just provide you entertainment. Because we all need that sometimes. You know, I think that's... We work hard for our money. I think we deserve to, you know, spend a little bit of it on ourselves. And I think $75 for a lot of those people, they look at it and go, yeah, okay. But then they realized, well, yeah, but I also did just buy this DMG for $50 at the retro store. And I, you know, bought a bunch of, you know, original Game Boy games for $10-$20 each. You know, they figure, well, I'm already like $200 into this thing, you know, with all the crap that they had to buy because maybe they didn't still have their original one. What's another $75 if it produces that big of an improvement? So the point I'm trying to make with that one is the people who are most into retro console modding now have the financial wherewithal to justify the price of some of these more advanced mods. And so it's becoming financially feasible to manufacture them, even at the relatively low sales volume that they move, right? They're not selling hundreds of thousands of those DMG IPS mods. I'd be surprised if they had ever sold more than 10,000 of them worldwide. It's probably, that's probably even an order of magnitude bigger than what it is. The second point is kind of tied to number one, and that is there over time has also been an increase in the number of people who are technically savvy enough to develop these console mods. So these are, this is looking at kind of like the producer side of the equation and not just the consumer. You know, those who grew up in the 80s and 90s, they were obviously much more exposed to technology. And so they were more eager to learn it. I would venture to guess, and I'm sure someone's done a study on this kind of thing, but I would venture to guess that there is a very dramatic increase in people who went into technical fields of that generation than there were of people who were like the generation prior. I mean, obviously, there has been an overall increase of people going into technical fields, but I feel like, you know, and this, I think this is kind of obvious, people who grew up in the 80s and 90s are much more likely to have gone into one of those fields than someone who was from, say, the 60s, you know, or maybe even the 70s. And there is some anecdotal evidence kind of behind this. Another episode that I did that I'm really proud of, and I'm happy that it garnered the views that it did, was an episode I did about kind of the history of software hacking for Texas Instruments graphing calculators. Because that's something, that's a scene I was kind of into for a very long time, ever since I got my first graphing calculator. And so I said in that episode, you know, a lot of the people who were really into doing all this kind of stuff in the 90s is when it started. You know, I ventured to guess in that episode that a decent number of those people who were getting into programming those calculators went on to become professional software developers. I've received a significant number of comments in that video from people who said, yeah, that was me. You know, they said they were that kid in the back of the class. Instead of actually working on their math homework, they were programming a game, or they were programming a piece of software to help them make their homework be easier. That was actually me. I mean, I remember writing a program for my, what was it, TI-83, that helped me do a bunch of equations that the calculator couldn't do natively. You know, it was just like you input the different values as variables into this program and boom, there, you know, it would run the quadratic equation against it or something like that. And it was an exercise both in like making my life easier, but also learning how to program. And that's the same thing with a lot of these people. You know, they said that they really kind of, because of that exposure to technology, even at a relatively small scale, like a graphing calculator, it kind of primed them mentally to move into a field like that professionally. So I think a decent number of these mods, and I know at least some of them are definitely in this category, but I think it's an even bigger proportion of the console mods we're seeing today are produced by people in their basements on evenings and weekends or their spare time, as opposed to being like a professional endeavor that they're doing as their job. And the people who are doing that work, you know, the evenings, the weekends, the free time as a hobby, they're doing that because they have knowledge in that field from their day job, right? So they're sitting at a desk at work during the day writing code for their company. They come home and they write code for their hobby, and their hobby happens to be retro gaming. So we're seeing just by sheer volume of people who are going into those fields, and coupled with feeling nostalgic about the consoles, we're starting to see more and, you know, more in quantity and also more in terms of creativity and advanced technology going into these mods. The third and final point is kind of the economic side to it, in that there's been a dramatic cost reduction for production of these things. It all comes, of course, down to Chinese manufacturing, but also some creativity around these mods. For example, that DMG IPS mod. If you were to design something like that from scratch, just off the top of your head, you'd be like, okay, well, I need to find a replacement screen that's the same size and shape and resolution as the original one in the Game Boy. Well, that's going to be a really difficult endeavor. And that's what a lot of people thought of when it came to doing like a custom backlit screen for the Game Boy Color. And this was another episode that I'm thankful did fairly well, where I talked about why there's no backlight kit specifically for the Game Boy Color, like there is for the DMG, where it's like peel the film off the back and stick a $10 panel behind it. The Game Boy Color's LCD doesn't work that way. But I also said in that video that it would be really expensive to build a direct drop-in replacement LCD that would give you that backlight, because you'd have to build it custom. That's expensive. I have it on good authority from a manufacturer of these parts that you're looking at least $100,000 just to design a custom LCD and to tool up the assembly line. That doesn't include the actual cost of producing it, the per unit cost, and how many you would need to produce to make it be financially feasible, let alone break even on that initial $100,000 investment. And that's manufacturing in China, mind you, right? That's as cheap as you can get. So we're seeing creativity in terms of, well, will another part work? Can we make another part work? And so we're looking at mods like that DMG IPS mod. There was the Taobao Game Boy Color. I'm trying to dig through my memory here. The Taobao Game Boy Color that I was very generously sent by a viewer, and I tore down in an episode where they just took a different LCD and they actually turned the thing 90 degrees, and then they let the software do the work to size the image correctly and position it in the right place physically on that LCD so that it worked correctly through the screen cutout on the front. So we've been seeing more, I think, creativity along those lines in terms of not like, well, you know, we have to make a custom part. I guess it's going to be expensive. Maybe we should forget it. And going down to, hey, you know, this part is like $5 each in volume. On its own, it wouldn't work, but I can like do some stuff to kind of hack it and make it work. That kind of stuff. That's a really big, I think, improvement. And then the DMG IPS mod does that exactly. The Ben Venn mod was a little bit smaller than the original, if memory serves. And a few others were kind of like that too, right? It's like, you know, just kind of pick the best thing that you have available, that mentality of something is better than nothing. You know, perfect is the enemy of the good, all, you know, whatever kind of platitudes you can think of along those lines, where it's like, you know, let's just get it out there. Let's just try to make it happen and see how people receive it. I think the combination of all three of those factors has kind of produced like this golden era for game console modding in ways that we never saw before, either due to the economics of doing it or simply the generational status of it. You know, when the console was brand new, and to mod when you had to go buy one, you know, that was kind of an expensive and risky proposition, right? Like if you wanted to buy a PlayStation 2 and install a mod chip in it back when they were new, I mean, the console itself was expensive and the mod chip was relatively expensive. And unless you paid someone a decent amount of money to do the work for you, you had to do it yourself. And if you weren't 100% certain, there was very real risk you could ruin your PlayStation 2. I know someone personally who that happened to way back when. And that sucks. Now, because you can buy these consoles used for often a lot less than what they went new, and they're available in greater quantities because of the people who just don't care about them, you can still find some of these at garage sales for relatively cheap. You know, it takes, I think, kind of the edge off of doing some of these mods. I think people are a little more willing to do them on their own now, which hopefully will then kind of spur maybe another generation down the road of people, hey, you know, I remember back in 2020 when I did that screen replacement, you know, on this DMG, you know, I'm working in software now. Maybe I can design something like that, you know, and it's 2030 or 2040 or whatever. It's going to be really interesting to see in many ways where console modding goes, both in terms of the technical aspect, but also kind of the social one, you know, how the community handles the development of future mods and the direction that they take. You know, maybe we will see kind of a point where they say, you know what, we need to take a bigger look at what are we actually trying to accomplish here? Are we actually making the gameplay better, or are we creating some of these mods simply for the sake of doing them? Either way, I'm really excited for the future, and I'm definitely going to be along for the ride. As always, thanks for listening.